The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
I'm Eric Townsend for the Financial Sense NewsHour. The Next Level is a new weekly program segment intended for investment professionals and more advanced private investors. This week's topic is the mechanisms and effects of arbitrage in precious metals markets. Joining me as my special guest on the program is Bron Sucecki, Manager of Analysis and Strategy at the Perth Mint. Bron, thanks for joining me on The Next Level.
Thank you, Eric.
Bron, why don't we start by briefly reviewing the meaning of the term arbitrage?
Sure. Arbitrage is really taking advantage of a difference in price in the same asset in different markets.
That's probably easier to understand through example. So let's start with location arbitrage. How does that work in precious metals markets?
Well, the nature of precious metals, of course, is that they're physical, and this does give rise to differences in prices between markets. So you can easily have a situation where there'll be, say, a lot of demand or supply in one market, say London, versus another market, say Perth. And if that price difference is large enough, then it creates a profit opportunity for a market player to take advantage of it.
So basically what's going on is if the price in London is higher than the price in Perth, then somebody who's got metal in Perth is going to send it to London in order to profit from that price difference.
Correct. As long as the price of gold between those two markets is larger than the shipment cost, it creates a profit.
So the arbitrage trade comes into play when there's a difference in price between two markets that's large enough to make it economic for somebody to ship the metal in order to take advantage of that price difference. Explain why that's actually a very different equation for gold versus silver.
Well, the difference comes down to the fact that gold compared to silver is a lot more value dense. Same amount of volume contains a lot more value. In that case, it makes more sense to ship gold via air. But in the case of silver, you really want to ship it via sea containers on boats. So if you're shipping via air for gold, it would only take a couple of days to get to its location. In the case of silver, it would take a couple of months to get there. So then you also have the cost of funding that position whilst in transit.
Okay, so arbitrage keeps the price of precious metals almost the same between different locations, with the almost part being determined by the cost of shipping, the amount of time it takes to do the shipping, the financing cost, depending on that time, import and export fees, and so on and so forth. And basically, when the price difference is significant enough to make it economic for somebody to arbitrage that price difference, they do so by moving the metal around. Now let's move on to price transmission through arbitrage and how that occurs between investment vehicles. The process of setting the price of any commodity by matching buyers and sellers' bids and offers is called price discovery. But precious metals investors have several different markets they could choose from. An investor who wants to buy gold could buy physical gold on the spot market. They could buy gold futures contracts. They could buy the GLD ETF. And each one of these has its own market of buyers and sellers. So you'd think that they could each have their own independent price, but somehow all these different instruments seem to stay in sync with one another in terms of price. Why is that, and how does it work?
This is very much similar to the physical location arbitrage play. And as soon as one market starts to increase or decrease relative to another, say there's a lot of buyers of the GLD ETF and that price starts getting bid up. And as that price moves up, it creates a gap to another market, say the London spot market. That gap creates a profit opportunity that a bullion bank takes advantage of by buying into one market and selling into the other market.
Let's walk through an example to illustrate how this works. Suppose that Harry hedge fund manager comes along and decides he's bullish on gold. So he starts buying COMEX futures contracts in size. What happens next?
Well, if he's buying in size, he would bid the price up to capture the limited number of sellers there are or to induce more people to come in and sell. So as the price starts to move up, a bullion bank notices that this futures price is now significantly higher, let's say $2 higher than the price that they can see in the London spot market. So the bullion bank will say, fine, I will go in and sell a futures contract at this price, which is higher, and then instantaneously I'll go into the London spot market and I'll buy gold. So they've sold one contract on a futures and they've bought the equivalent amount of gold in the spot market. So they've bought and sold, so they don't have a position in terms of exposure to price, but they've captured by that difference in price a profit.
I think this is a particularly important example to understand because the hot money usually prefers COMEX futures as their trading vehicle, primarily because of the leverage that they offer. I think there's an important point hidden in this, which is that a lot of analysts focus on the commitment of traders report in an effort to gauge the activities and the sentiments of the largest commercial traders. Most of the COT analysis that I've read is based on the premise that increases or decreases in the biggest commercial bank's net futures exposure on the COMEX tells a story about those bullion banks' outlook on the market. But from what you're saying, it sounds like the increases and decreases in net exposure we see each month in the COT report might actually be nothing more than a reflection of arbitrage flows between the COMEX and the London market. Do I understand that right?
Yes, correct. In that previous example, let's assume a bullion bank doesn't have a position, they're neutral. If they see lots of buying occurring and the prices being bid up, creating a gap to the spot market or any other market, they will go in and sell contracts, and as I said, they will buy. So they've sold futures, but they've bought physical. They don't have a position. But all that we see on the COT is just this increasing short position of the commercials. So it's a bit hard to really make any emphatic interpretation from that about whether the bullion bank is actually short or long, or whether they are merely reflecting the hedging that they're doing into another market or the arbitrage.
So what we see in the COT report appears to be a considerable increase or decrease in commercial net short exposure in a given month could actually reflect zero change in those banks' overall net exposure because those banks are simply moving their exposure back and forth between London and COMEX and other markets in order to take advantage of the small price discrepancies that develop from time to time between those markets. I would think the same thing could work in reverse. In other words, if there were suddenly a big surge of buying demand in London, that could result in the opposite arbitrage, where the bullion banks are decreasing their COMEX shorts and increasing their London exposure. Is that right?
Yes, it can work the other way. To a bullion bank, they look at all of these markets. They're looking at not just futures markets and the spot over-the-counter market, but they're also looking at all the ETFs around the world, and they're observing all of that simultaneously. If they've got excess buying or selling in either one of those markets, they'll look at whether which market has got the reverse position, so less selling or more buying, and they will arbitrage all between each of those. So the arbitrage can go one way or the other. It depends on the flow and depends on the demand and supply. Generally, the London over-the-counter market is significantly larger than the COMEX market, but also the ETFs and the volume that flows through them, and they're quite significant. You know, in the US time zone, it may be that COMEX is seeing a lot more volume, so it's COMEX that's being arbitraged into the spot market, whereas when we get into the Asian time zone, it could be more of a spot market that's operating, and that's being pushed into, say, a Tokyo futures market. Then again, in COT analysis, it's hard to interpret which way is the flow going. Is it the spot market being pushed into COMEX or COMEX being arbitraged into the spot market? It's very hard to say.
I want to pick up on the point you made about ETFs now, because so far we were talking about COMEX futures being arbitraged back and forth to the London market. But ETFs such as GLD have their own bid and ask that's determined by the supply and demand for ETF shares. Now, retail investors who buy GLD don't have the option of taking delivery of the gold, and that would seem on the face of it to rule out an arbitrage trade to or from GLD, at least so far as we've discussed it at this point. But GLD does seem to be arbitraged, so how does that work?
Yes, that's true. For the retail investor, you really have to take the price that's offered on the exchange. However, there are special participants called authorized participants, APs, who enter into contractual arrangements with the issuer of the ETF, and they are allowed to deliver gold to the ETF or redeem gold from the ETF in exchange for shares. And it's this ability to have shares issued to them or to redeem shares for physical that enables them to arbitrage the ETF price against the spot price.
So these guys basically have a license to create or destroy ETF shares by delivering or redeeming metal in order to create or destroy them. So they're arbitraging back and forth to the ETF literally by creating or destroying shares in the ETF as they deliver metal to and from other markets.
Yes, correct. And that's quite important. If you don't have the ability to buy or sell clearly and without restriction between the two markets, then it becomes difficult for you to arbitrage it. And that's why the ETFs were designed with that mechanism to allow specific large volume bullion banks and others that have trading desks to be able to deliver or redeem gold from the fund in exchange for shares. It's crucial to allowing them to actually arbitrage, and probably more so than arbitrage, but really keeping the price in line. So the arbitrage that you see on the ETFs really is very, very tight, given that there are so many authorised participants. They all compete against each other to make sure that the price of the ETFs does not diverge too far from the spot. So it's almost seamless to the retail investor.
So what you're saying is the mechanism of arbitrage is actually what allows the ETF to stay exactly in sync with the price of gold as it trades in other markets. But that may be true for something like GLD, but if you look at other funds like the Central Fund of Canada or the Sprott Physical Gold Trust, they often trade at a considerable premium over their net asset value. So it seems like arbitrage is working for some of these funds, but not for others. Please explain why that's the case.
Yes, well, if you look at these close-end funds, the word close is the key thing there. What it means is that it's closed to new inflows. You can't go to the issuer of those ETFs and say, oh, look, here's some gold, please issue me some shares. They make an issue and then it's closed. So what happens then if there is more buying and there's a lot of demand and people wish to buy, say, the PHYS, then they have to bid the price up. Then as they bid the price up, they've got to bid it from people who existingly hold it. There isn't an availability for someone else to come in and say, okay, I will give gold and get shares and then I'll sell these shares to the people that want them. So the price starts getting bid up because there is only the existing holders and they're the ones that have to be induced to sell. It's not possible to arbitrage it. It's not possible to go in and create new shares. And that's what creates this premium and has the premium fluctuating up and down depending on how much buying demand there is for it.
So essentially, the design of the ETF mechanism is to allow arbitrageurs, principally bullion banks, to create and destroy shares. And in so doing, they keep the price exactly in sync with the other gold markets. But if you're talking about a closed-end fund like Sprott, PHYS, or Central Fund of Canada, it's not possible to arbitrage in and out of those. Therefore, their price kind of goes independently. Now, you've explained why PHYS or Central Fund of Canada could trade at a premium to its net asset value. You would think it could also trade by the same token at a discount if investors started bailing out of PHYS at the same time and it fell out of sync with the market. But that's not actually true, is it?
No, well, there is one difference is that whilst they're closed to new inflows, they're not closed to outflows. So there is the ability to actually redeem for physical. So they can arbitrage on the discount side. So as the price gets bid down, they can actually buy that up and then redeem for physical. So in a sense, you've got an arbitrage ability on one side, but you don't have it on the buying demand side where you can issue shares into it.
Okay, so because of the redeemability clause, those funds can be arbitraged in one direction but not the other, and that allows them to develop a premium but not a significant discount. Let's move on. We talked about futures contracts earlier. There's always dozens of different contracts to choose from with different delivery dates. Many investors assume that the backwardation or contango, meaning the difference between the price that is quoted for the nearest delivery month and the longer dated contracts, could be interpreted as the market's forecast for which way the price is headed in the future. Is that true? Does that really hold up?
It's a common mistake, actually, to think that a futures market is a prediction of the future price. There's a difference between the word future and forecast. So probably best through an example to explain why that's not the case. Consider we've got a spot price to make a simple calculation of $1,000 an ounce. And let's say we've got a lot of buyers in the futures market and there's a contract for 12 months and they're very keen to buy that because they think the price is going to go to $1,200. So they start bidding this contract up and it moves up to, say, $1,100. So when a bullion bank looks at that, they see a big profit. They go, wow, the spot price is $1,000, but this futures contract, people are willing to pay $1,100 for it. So what they will do is go in and borrow $1,000 at, say, 1% interest. They use that $1,000 to buy an ounce in a spot market, and they'll store that ounce in a COMEX warehouse, let's say, for 1% cost.
Okay, so their cost of arbitrage then is 1% interest or 1% storage, total of 2% or $20 or $1,020 for that ounce in order to buy it and then hold it for that year.
Correct. So they've all in cost, as you said, of $1,020, and they've got 1 ounce of physical sitting in the COMEX warehouse. So they then can go into the COMEX market and short or sell a 12-month contract at $1,100, sit around and wait for 12 months, and then deliver that ounce into the contract and get their $1,100. And then in the 12 months' time, they then pay back the $1,000 loan, $10 interest, $10 storage, and they make $80 profit. So others see this profit and go, well, you know, we'll do the same thing here. But, you know, one guy might go into the market and try to undercut this initial bullion bank. So, well, I'll take, you know, $1,090. And of course, what happens is that the next guy comes in and says, well, I'm happy with a $60, you know, profit. And they start willing to accept lower and lower prices for that 12-month future contract. And in the end, what will happen is obviously this competition between all of these different traders and arbitragers is that they end up bringing that 12-month future price down to effectively the cost of the arbitrage, which is $1,020. So what happens is that the futures price for 12 months becomes $1,020, and it really is just reflecting the cost of doing the arbitrage between now and 12 months' time, which was, as we said, the cost of borrowing money and the cost of storing the metal in the interim in the warehouse. And competition between the arbitragers keeps that, effectively, that futures price in lockstep with the spot price, the only difference really being the cost of doing that arbitrage.
That's very interesting, because it's another explanation that you don't often hear, explaining why bullion banks often hold net short exposure on the COMEX. They could be basically just holding on to metal in order to benefit from some arbitrage trade that requires that they sit on that short position for several months before making delivery. Now, several commenters have opined that backwardation in the term structure of the futures market, meaning that the price for immediate delivery is actually higher than the price for future delivery, would be an indication that there's an imminent risk of a system breakdown or default or something going very badly wrong, because the higher cost seems to signal fear among market participants that longer dated contracts wouldn't be honored. Does that rationale make sense?
Backwardation can mean that, but only if the backwardation is larger than the transaction cost of doing the arbitrage. Backwardation is really the reverse of the earlier example that we discussed, in the sense that instead of the bullion bank buying gold and storing it and then delivering it in, what they're doing is selling gold now and buying a futures contract. If you look at that cost of doing that arbitrage, if the gap's really wide and the profit's being foregone, then yes, it would indicate that something's wrong. You would be saying, why isn't the bullion bank taking advantage of that arbitrage? And that fear may be that they're not going to get the gold back from the COMEX in the future, or some problem of liquidity in the market at that point. The problem is that when people see backwardation, they really don't take into account the cost of doing an arbitrage. So they look at it and see, yes, that the futures price is lower than the spot price and say, wow, there's backwardation, there's something wrong going on. But they're not really aware of the cost of the arbitrage, so they can't actually see if there's a real profit that is actually being foregone and left in the market. I remember there was a recent article where someone made an observation that the May silver contract was giving away a 3% annualized profit to anyone who would sell physical now and buy a futures contract in a few weeks. Now, when you look at that example, he was talking more of a time period around 10 days, and the 3% annualized on, say, $30 was 90 cents. If you put that 90 cents down to the two-week period, it ends up being around about 3 or 4 cents. Now, 3 or 4 cents is barely the cost of shipping the metal, let alone any other costs of executing the arbitrage. If you define backwardation not just as the futures price is less than spot, but the futures price after arbitrage costs is less than spot, is really the correct definition of backwardation. And if you did that in this example, you'd find that there actually wasn't a backwardation. So yes, pro traders should really not be leaving a profit on the table, but that has to actually be a profit that's on the table. And so in a lot of cases with the backwardation, you've got to ask yourself, yes, the price is lower, but is that price low enough to make it a profitable arbitrage?
Okay, so a very useful rule to know is if the spot price should exceed the near-term futures price by enough that somebody's leaving a profit on the table, that's a huge red flag. That tells you something's wrong. But the common mistake people make is if it exceeds it by any amount, even an unprofitable backwardation, people are perhaps incorrectly assuming that that's a signal that something's wrong when it really isn't. So the key is to understand that backwardation is only significant to the extent it exceeds the transaction cost of arbitrage.
Correct. The thing is, it's easy to see spot and futures prices and see when they differ. It's a lot harder to know at that point in time what is actually the cost of doing the arbitrage. So taking that example of COMEX, if you're looking at a significant price difference, one of the most liquid markets would be London. So the only way of really arbitraging any significant volume would be to ship metal from London into New York. Now, the cost of doing that shipment, a lot of commentators are not aware of what that cost is. They don't understand all the logistical issues, the delays that might occur, particularly, say, in the case of ship silver. You know, you're not going to fly silver in. You know, you're going to ship silver. It's going to take a couple of months to arrive. All of those things come into play. And indeed, the shipment costs change during the year. You know, they might have around Christmas, the freight costs will be a lot higher. So all of those factors are very dynamic, and it makes it very difficult if you're not a industry player and aware of all those costs to actually work out, well, wait a minute, is this so-called arbitrage profit that I see here, is it really an arbitrage profit or not?
Now, there's another popular theory that I think is related to this, which is some people expect the price of paper gold, referring to ETF shares and futures contracts and so forth, to eventually decouple from the price of physical metal. Some people are even saying that as faith is lost in the financial system, a huge premium will develop for allocated physical metal over the so-called paper price that's quoted on the COMEX and other paper exchanges, including GLD shares, for example. Some observers have even opined that this phenomenon has already begun, citing the premium that's being paid for PHYS shares over GLD shares as evidence that investors are willing to pay a higher price for a fund that holds allocated bullion and offers redemption options and so on and so forth to retail investors, not just to authorized participants. Would you agree with those views?
Well, this whole issue of paper and physical divergence is a very complex matter because ultimately it does come down to arbitrage. When you say that the paper and physical prices are diverging, what you're saying is that professional industry players are not arbitraging. So on the face of it, I sort of look to that and go, well, I highly doubt it because as much as you may or may not trust banks, you can be sure that they are profit-driven, and if there's a profit to be made, they will take it. So the only way that you really will get a divergence of anything, whether it be paper gold to a physical spot gold, is if it can't be arbitraged. Now, what might be an example of that? Well, you could have a closure of the stock exchange for some reason, or a physical delivery can't be made in and out of a product. So as in the case of the spot physical trust, you can't deliver gold and get shares to take advantage of a premium. So in that case, that's why you do have a divergence there, but it's a divergence in that product's price. It doesn't reflect a divergence in the spot market. It's more that the spot market is where it is and that the product that is not able to be arbitraged into is the one that's going to diverge. But because the spot market can always be traded, it's unlikely that that is diverging. It's more that the other products who can't be arbitraged for whatever reason are diverging. Now, that does mean that it's possible, for example, with COMEX, that COMEX could diverge if you are unable to make delivery into a COMEX warehouse or there was some problem with the trading of the product, then yes, the price would diverge. But whilst it is possible to arbitrage, whilst possible to, without restriction, buy and sell the two different things, it's not really going to be possible to have a price divergence occur.
So basically, if it's possible to arbitrage, there's no way for the physical and the paper products to be different. But some products, like the Sprott Physical Trust, by design, don't allow arbitrageurs to arbitrage into the fund. So therefore, a premium develops because arbitrage by its design is not possible. Fascinating stuff, but we're already out of time. In future episodes of The Next Level, we'll explore other aspects of precious metals markets mechanics, including the implications and extent of fractionalization of unallocated bullion accounts, the reserve ratios of the bullion banks, the role of the COMEX warehouse inventory as a buffer to absorb delivery failures, plus a host of other issues, including an in-depth analysis of what would really happen if all the paper longs suddenly wanted to stand for physical delivery. But for now, we're out of time. So before we close, Bron, please tell our listeners how they can follow your work.
Sure, Eric. I write for the Perth Mint's blog, which people can find at perthmintbullion.com.
Again, you can find more of Bron's work at perthmintbullion.com. My guest has been Bron Suchecki of the Perth Mint, and I hope you've enjoyed this episode of The Next Level. If you'd like to suggest other advanced investing topics or guests for future episodes of The Next Level, please email your suggestions to me through the Financial Sense website. For the Financial Sense NewsHour, I'm Eric Townsend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.